I hope you are all getting hungry, because we have a great lunch in a few moments. But the message of this morning is it's a serious message. I thought a lot about this this morning, and I thought a lot about our message, and I prayed about it. You know, before we begin, I'd like to say a word of prayer. I know we just prayed, but let us say another word of prayer. Dear Father in heaven, thank you for all of your blessings, and thank you for being worthy of our worship. Father, as we open the word, and as we seek to understand your will for us, please open our hearts and open our minds, Father, to what you want, and not to what we want. Fulfill your will through us, I ask you in Jesus' name, amen. You know, the book of Revelation describes the climax of human history in the terms of a mega polarization. At the end, two sides will remain on planet Earth. Those who worship God and the Lamb, and those who worship the dragon, the beast, and its image. Those who receive the mark of the beast. In fact, from chapter 12 to chapter 14 of Revelation, you'll find the word worship repeatedly, at least 8 times, because that is the focus. That is the center of the consummation of the conflict of the ages. And just for you to get a broader idea of what we're going to be talking about this morning, I'm going to read a few texts here. And if you want to try to accompany, I'm going to read it quickly because we don't have that much time. But for example, Revelation 13:4 says, "So they worshiped the dragon who gave authority to the beast, and they worshiped the beast." Revelation 13:8, "All who dwell on the earth will worship him, the beast." He was granted power, Revelation 13:15. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. Revelation 14:7 that Chandra just read, "Fear God and give him glory, for the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth and the sea and springs of water." Revelation 14:9-10, "Then a third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, 'If anyone worships the beast and his image and receives his mark on his forehead or on his hand, he himself shall also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation.'" 8 times in just 2 chapters, all the attention is cast upon one subject: worship. Worship. This word is the crucial word, the key word in this section of the book. In the end, the test of truth will be centered upon what? Worship. That's what it's all going to be about in the end. Worship. However, my dear friends, this is nothing new. This isn't anything new. Worship is the key thread that is knitted all throughout the Bible. Cain and Abel, what were they divided upon? Worship. How to worship. We know of the battle of the worshipers of Jehovah and the worshipers of Baal on Mount Carmel. What was the conflict about? Worship. In Daniel chapter 3, when those three young men stood up on that plain of Dura, what was the struggle about? Worship. Worship. Actually, when you study this subject of Nebuchadnezzar's statue, you'll find that this is the outline, this is the background to the image of the beast that is set up in Revelation. Throughout the history of Israel's idolatry, worship is the central focus of that conflict. In the desert of temptation, when Satan tried to tempt Jesus in many regards, in many things, to make him fall and give up on his plan of redemption, what was the central focus of his temptation? Worship. How to worship. Who to worship. The nature of worship itself. That was the central issue. The fact that our first 4 commandments are based on this theme should tell us a lot. The first commandment: thou shalt have no other gods before you. Loyalty. Loyalty in worship. The second has to do with the nature and how to worship. Thou shalt not make any graven images. The third commandment, thou shalt not take the Lord's name in vain. That has to do with the reverence of worship. The fourth has to do with obedience. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. These are the essential principles of worship. This is why worship is the essential theme, the main theme in the final scenes of our time here on planet Earth. And here, the question that arises is, how do you treat worship? What is worship to you? Is worship just singing? Is worship just coming to church with the clothes, the right clothes? Is worship, what is worship? How do you treat worship in your life? Of course, worship, it's not limited to coming to church. But each week when you come, you are building the habits that will ultimately determine what side you will be on in the end. Remember, first you form a habit. And then after that habit is formed in your life, then that habit defines who you are. Then it forms you. In the end, your habits, they're a reflection of your commitment, of your relationship to Jesus. Your habits, if you read the Bible, if you pray, if you come to church, if you consider it important, these habits, they say a lot. They speak in a loud voice as to who you are and who God is to you. We spoke about this in our Sabbath school today. Who is God to you? How have you experienced God? Today, this is our theme. This is our subject. But it's a serious theme. It's a serious subject. Because what I've noticed is that worship has become something completely different in our church culture. Worship is not what it should be, what it once was. Attendance to church has become a strange practice in the Western mentality of our day, the consumerist mentality of our day. Millions of Christians would prefer to stay at home on Sabbath, to stay in bed, to mow their lawn, to go to work. Maybe clean out the garage. Maybe go to the mall. Watch a football game or a baseball game or a soccer game. Many Christians would prefer to go to the dentist and have their tooth extracted rather than go to church. Some years ago, I read in a church bulletin a quote from a minister named Dr. Henry Harley, a Protestant minister that lived most of his ministry in the first half of the 20th century. And he said something that struck a chord with me that day, and it still does. He said that the greatest weakness of Protestantism today is the absence of its members at church meetings. That's a simple thing, but it's our greatest problem. Just look around you. Look at the empty pews. Look at these empty spaces. Where are the people? You know them. Where are they? On Wednesday, when we come for Bible, I know that many cannot attend. But it's interesting to see that some of the busiest people that I know here at this church, they're there. They don't give an excuse. What's our excuse? The greatest weakness in Protestantism today is the absence of its members at church. However, this isn't our only weakness. Perhaps our greatest weakness is the attitude of those who do come. According to statistics, men are the most tempted. Did you know this? According to statistics, men are the most tempted. To many men, if it weren't for the example that they feel that they have to leave to their children, that they must show their children, they would have banished the experience of coming to church a long time ago. But what these parents don't realize at this is that this reluctance to come, this unwillingness of coming, it's easily perceived by their kids. And that poisons their children's comprehension of church. When we amputate church from our experience, we are committing a serious mistake. Because here at church we find a kind of joy, a kind of happiness, a kind of fellowship that we find nowhere else. You won't find this anywhere else. Many are reluctant to come. On another bulletin at that same church, I read a text that mentioned excuses that people frequently use to not come to church. And I want to show you some of these excuses. Some people would say, you know, someone offended me. And that would begin a long list of, you know, someone offended me, the church offended me, offended my feelings, made me feel bad, and I don't want to go back there. Have you ever heard anyone say this? I've heard that a lot. Another reason that people use, another excuse is, you know, the church is full of hypocrites. The church is full of hypocrites. Full of hypocrites. Well, maybe a solution would be to exclude everyone from church. Let's disfellowship everyone. But then the problem would be bigger, because then you simply wouldn't have a church. The problem with this comprehension is that people, they confuse sinfulness with hypocrisy. Everyone in here is a sinner. Am I wrong? We're all sinners in here. We don't deny that. We strive to live up to a higher guideline, a higher standard, but we are sinners. The fact that we sin doesn't mean that we're all hypocrites. It means that we're sinners. We know what we should be doing, but we're often unable to live this. That's not hypocrisy, my friends. That's sinfulness. There's a difference. Some other people say, you know, I don't go to church because I'm not good enough. I've heard that a lot, actually. You know, I'm not good enough to go to church. Let me fix my life first, and then I'll go. This is the equivalent of a diseased person saying, you know, I'm too sick to go see the doctor. I'm too sick to go to the hospital. Doesn't make sense. Other people will say, you know, the church seems dead. The service is tiresome and boring. I don't receive anything over there. Now, this is said as if the main reason of going to church was to distract myself, to entertain ourselves, or to receive something. My dear brothers and sisters, we come to church primarily to worship, to adore, and to thank God. That's what we're here for. Other people say, you know, I've been too busy lately. I have no time. I'm sorry, but this is precisely the purpose of Sabbath. That's what Sabbath is for. You're busy? That's why God gave you Sabbath. That resting time. Usually when people say this, what they mean, and if you ask them, they won't admit it, but let them investigate their own lives. Usually what we're saying by this is, you know, I'm too busy for God. I'm too busy for his body, the church. I have heard others say, you know what, Pastor? I'm too sick. Now, I understand that this is true for many people. I understand this. I understand that there are many people that if they could, in a heartbeat, they'd be here. Ask Mama Jo. I know she'd be here. But some other people use that as an excuse. And sometimes I've wondered, you know what? What if God actually made us as sick as we make ourselves appear sometimes? Then we would really know what being sick means. Some of the most faithful people I've found in my life, members of church, were some of the sickest, battling throughout their life with many infirmities. Some other people say, you know what, Pastor, I don't believe all this church stuff anymore. And this is also not a big surprise. If you spent more time on your knees with your open Bible instead of sitting on your sofa with your TV control or your phone in your hand, you would certainly believe differently. Other people say, you know, I'm too tired on Saturday. I've worked hard all week. I got in late yesterday. I got in, you know, early today. I can't go. It's not even worth it. I'm too tired. The thing is, my dear friends, and I don't want to lose any friends here. The thing is that we're rarely too tired to do things that we want to do. You know, I was impressed in the World Cup, the Soccer World Cup of 2014. It was hosted, it was in Brazil. It was in Brazil. And the Germans won. And I had always heard that the German population, the Germans, they're more of a colder people, you know, they're more serious, reserved, kind of indifferent. But with each goal that German team did, that coach, he was jumping like a kangaroo. Happy, emotional. And I learned something very, very important that day. People get excited with what they like, with what they consider important. people are unmotivated with things that they are not interested in. And that's the problem. We're not too tired to go shopping. We're not too tired to go play football or to watch a movie or to go out with friends or to make some dinner. People generally do what they like doing. They like doing things that they consider important. And the real question here is church important to you? Others say, you know, church is too far. It's just too far. It's too much for me to go. Too far. You know, some of the most faithful people in this church, when it comes to frequency, are those that live the farthest. Sometimes I've asked myself, you know, what if Jesus used this excuse? Jesus, who crossed galaxies, who came down to this sinful, dark, dreary world to save me, what if he had used this excuse? It's just too far. Too much work. Too much mileage. Imagine if Jesus had used that excuse. Some other people, reflecting their reluctance to come to church, they say, you know what? I don't get anything out of it. And then they add, and here, I have to be careful, but I also have to say what I gotta say. They say, they start a long list of what if. Or if only, I'm sorry, if only. A long list of reasons, all beginning if only. If only the pianist played my kind of music. If only the music were this way or that way. If only we went back to singing from the old hymnal, or newer contemporary songs. If only we had more skits instead of sermons. If only the preacher would talk less. This preacher talks too much. He doesn't use stories that I like. If only the pastor would preach about this subject or that subject. If only the pews were more comfortable. If only the service were better. If only the sound system were of a higher quality. If only the youth programs were better and more often. If only, if only, if only, if only. Perhaps you can identify with one of these what ifs. I know that I can sometimes. I'm not coming down harsh because this is your problem, it's not mine. This is a collective problem. Perhaps you can identify. And it may be, as we analyze this subject, it may be that the problem you see in church worship does not really lie in the church's hands, but in your comprehension of what worship is. The church, my dear friends, the church is not a place where we come to be entertained. The church is not a place we go to have fun. The church is not a place where an audience sits with their arms crossed to watch a show. The church does not put on a spectacle where some worn-out actors have to strive to please bored and humorless spectators. The church is not a place where people put on a mask of disapproval to tell the preacher if they are or are not liking the show. The church does not have a stage. It has an altar. On the stage, there's performance, but on the altar, there is sacrifice. The church does not offer a show. It offers worship. A show offers exhibition, but worship offers rendition. The church has no stars. It has servants. Stars shine. Servants obey. The church has no fans. It has disciples. Fans applaud and flatter. Disciples learn and follow. The church does not have artists. It has ministers. Artists act. Ministers serve. The church does not have an audience. It has worshipers. An audience watches and reacts while worshipers bow in reverence and surrender themselves. I remember this one time in Canada. My father is a pastor, and we were leaving church that day. And my father, he was, saying goodbye to the church members. And I used to pretend that I was a little pastor. I had my suit on. I was a little guy. And I remember this one time, a lady coming up to my dad, and she told him point blank, she said, "Pastor, all you have to do to see if I'm liking your